Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly pod and video cast brought to you by the magazine Free Minds and Free Markets. I am a very videogenic Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangyu Ward. Happy almost spring day, everyone.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Thank you for giving me all of my syllables, every single one.
We're going to add another one as the year goes on. It's going to be a rough year, I'm predicting, for a lot of things, including the syllables in your weird Romanian name. Let's get right to the news, shall we? On Saturday, former South Carolina governor and Trump administration ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, lost the Republican presidential primary to Donald Trump in her home state by 20 percentage points. This makes Haley 0-for-5 state contests. Well, one of them was in the Virgin Islands. That's fine. It's a state. She's losing the delegate count 110-20. As CNN put it, no other major modern candidate has refused to drop out of the race after so many losses. And in the run-up to next week's Super Tuesday primary palooza of 15 states, plus a handful that's happening in the weekend just before, Haley has lost the financial backing of the deep-pocketed Koch network of political fund givers. Let's head over to the Drudge Report and see how our Trump-hating internet pioneer is taking it. Let's see. 40% of Republicans vote against Trump in SC. He blares out demographic warning signs and divided party. I think he's saying there might be almost a chance. Catherine, you're a lady. Do you want to deliver a eulogy for neocon Nikki and or the idea that anyone will ever challenge Donald Trump in the GOP while he is still drawing or wheezing breath?
I do think at this point, anyone who's running against Trump is just using a campaign strategy that's like very similar to Pascal's wager. Like, we're just running for office in case there is a God, right? Like, we're just running for office in case somehow, some way, Donald Trump isn't available to run or serve as president. I guess, I think that this is nothing has actually changed. And that's what's weird. It's like we keep covering over and over, like Nikki Haley and anyone else who is not Donald Trump is still not going to be the Republican nominee. But that has been true for many, many months. And maybe for many years, maybe for as long as any of us can remember. Maybe like, was there even a time before Donald Trump? I still actually don't think it's crazy to just stay in the race, because this race is going to be weird and chaotic. And to just stay in the race on the off chance that that is relevant for who becomes president still strikes me as a rational strategy, but it's a pretty tough road.
Sorry, this race is going to be chaotic and weird?
It's going to continue to be chaotic and weird.
Yeah. It hasn't been that chaotic and weird.
It's kind of totally predictable.
Very normal to have a candidate win basically on the nomination while also being on trial in like 17
Not
different states.
Stuff,
it's pretty,
like the
it's
race
very normal
itself
stuff.
Is proceeding through the standard steps of a presidential primary.
Speaking of chaotic and weird, let's go to Nick, whose Twitter feed is just filled with naked blue men. Nick, the never Trump.
You've been watching Avatar again?
Yes.
This is Avatar come to life, and it's worse when it's an actual 3D.
Our never Trumper friends like to point to stuff like the South Carolina exit poll showing that basically one third of Republican voters say that a guilty verdict in one of his 17 trials would render Trump unfit to be the president, or they just point to all the various Trumpy candidates, including the one whose name is before the E, losing in general elections time and time again. Is that just copium in the face of, a doddering Joe Biden, or do you think that Trump's ceiling of support is actually lower than the usual 46%?
No, I think it's about the same, because when you look at independents, and also if you look, I recently read Patrick Ruffini's Party of the People, He's a Republican pollster who works for Echelon Institutes or Echelon. What is the
Insights?
What's it?
It's Insights.
Echelon Insights. They got Insights.
Esselen Institute.
Esselen.
Yeah, he's sitting in a big well, you know hot tub in Big Sur with your naked blue man.
It's not Esselen. It's Echelon. Echelon. In any case, they've got bigger problems than the inability to remember their name. By all real Americans. But, you know, his book, which is very interesting, shows a lot, you know, a fairly significant swing towards Trump from working class voters of all races, creeds, and colors. So it may be that Trump loses a little bit of never Trump Republican support, but he's going to quite possibly be picking that up from black men, which he did in 2020 substantially, as well as Hispanic votes, because Joe Biden is incredibly unpopular about that. But so I think that Trump is probably still stuck in the 46% range, as he did in the last two elections. It may be enough to win, because another point that Ruffini makes, and I think I certainly didn't appreciate fully, is, you know, basically the 2020 election came down to about 40,000 votes spread over three states, which is kind of submerged in the popular vote that Joe Biden won pretty handily, as well as the electoral vote, which was a blowout. It's a very, very close race, and it's mostly very close because Joe Biden is so unpopular. He's at 38%, according to the latest Gallup poll, which is basically the lowest approval rating that he's had ever since.
Peter, what, if any, are the policy implications of Trumpism remaining triumphant in the primary process for a third consecutive time?
Well, I think first and foremost, from a reason perspective, from the sort of things that we're concerned about here on this podcast, that tells you that the Republican Party is not going to be the party of fiscal responsibility, because the clearest difference between Trump and Nikki Haley, and just in terms of certainly in terms of domestic policy, but really in terms of rhetoric, in terms of like clarity about like what we're going to do with this whole government thing that the, you know, the president is supposed to be the executive of, is that Nikki Haley said I want to be clear, that's not did, but said the most fiscally responsible stuff of any of the candidates, certainly any of the candidates who, you know, was running at number 2, 3, 4, or 5 at any point during the Republican primary. And so I think this is, to the extent that Trump is winning and to the extent that Trump has a grip on the Republican Party, that is a sign that Republicans have totally given up on any kind of fiscal responsibility, especially where entitlements are concerned. And then the second thing is that the Trump GOP is very much going to become not only not the party of fiscal responsibility, but the party of we've got to shut down the border and we've got to do a bunch of terrible stuff on trade and tariffs in the name of protecting American jobs.
Catherine, let me read to you some of Haley's post-election comments. Excuse me. I'm an accountant. I'm not Nikki Haley's. I know 40% isn't 50%, but I also know that 40% is not a small number. Americans deserve a choice in this election. Also, I'm fighting because huge numbers of Republican primary voters are saying that they want an alternative, and because 70% of Americans don't want to see a Trump-Biden rematch, end quote. Are you feeling the no-labels-mentum here, Catherine?
I have never and will never feel no-labels-mentum. I'm sorry, or I guess delighted to report. I mean, as the kids probably stopped saying already, the math is mathing. Like, she is not wrong about those numbers. People broadly don't like the options they have. That's like very, very true. And that does not translate to people love and desire Nikki Haley, which is, I think, the thing she would like to imply there. But yeah, like the electorate is signaling over and over in every way that it can that it is greatly dissatisfied with the idea of a Trump-Biden race. That doesn't mean we won't have one. In fact, we almost definitely will. And it doesn't mean that one of these jerks isn't going to be president, because there is actually no mechanism for the none of the above that I so desperately long for. That is the momentum I want. I don't want no labels mentum. I want none of the above mentum. And that is not currently available to us in the presidential contest sadly.
It's true that the numbers don't translate to a Nikki Haley primary victory. She is not going to be the Republican nominee. On the other hand, there are some reasonably good polls that do show that Nikki Haley outperforms Donald Trump in a race against Joe Biden, and that Haley would be a better candidate in the general. The issue here is that Republican primary voters, which are a small subset even of general election Republican voters, are not interested, or at least not interested enough in Nikki Haley.
I just want to call bullshit on Nikki Haley using the "I'm an accountant," speaking from an identity position, Matt. We want to live in a world of universal, you know, kind of enlightenment values.
You don't see job titles?
Exactly. Yeah. I don't see CPAs. No, it's just it doesn't exist.
You know,
the fact is, polls, irrelevant.
If you look at Real Clear Politics and a couple of other places that you know, pull all this stuff together and average it, Trump is already beating Biden at this point among likely voters. So good luck, Nikki Haley. Maybe she can go back to the UN. I hear they need, you know, they need at least 10% of new people in Gaza.
It's also February.
Because 10% were part of Hamas, Matt Welch.
Thanks. The jokes always get better.
Yeah.
I don't know if that
with the explaining.
I'll take it down a notch.
Yeah. No labels fact check here, at least according to the last time I paid attention to this, which was a week ago because I was on vacation for a week. No Labels was planning on announcing its decision or coming to a decision and perhaps announcing it about whether they were going to use their ballot access, which they have achieved in at least 14 states and attempt and will are trying to get to 32. They'll make that decision after Super Tuesday, which is March 5th, I do believe. Joe Manchin, Peter's favorite senator, announced recently that he was not going to be seeking the presidential nomination with No Labels or anybody else. And part of the reason is that I suspect is that one of the only polls that showed him in the race thrown up as a candidate, he was getting 3%, which leads me to a final conclusion, which is that the No Labels Center, which is also very like pro military intervention, in addition to talking about like, reforming Social Security and long-term entitlement state and such, and has a lot of a long-time professional politicians such as Vinegar Joe Lieberman. It's not a very popular center, is my feeling.
Matt, there are literally dozens of political consultants who would vote for that ticket.
I know.
We can see them all from where we are sitting here in Washington, D.C. We actually have sight lines on the entire No Labels electorate.
Can you imagine just people sitting there? They know that they're sitting on like $70 million and like, oh, I could spend that $70 million. Nick, you're next. Trump, in his recent speech at CPAC, which I believe is the Conservative Political Action Conference, he called his wife Mercedes.
Well, maybe he's in a polycule now with Mercedes Schlapp, who's the wife of the main organizer. Matt Schlapp and Mercedes Schlapp.
Everything in this podcast.
I aspire to get married to a woman who's named after a luxury car, by the way.
You're not wrong.
Lexus Gillespie.
Yep. Town car Lexus. Gillespie.
Oh, yeah. Cadillac. Could be a non-binary Cadillac.
This question is not going to work anymore, but
I don't. Can we just talk about Javier Milei instead?
What I was going to say, because I don't, Trump's talk at CPAC is neither here nor there, but there is footage that one of his handlers took of Javier Milei hugging Trump as he came off the stage, and Trump is about to go on, and it's about a minute and a half long. We can put it in the show notes or whatever, or look for it on Twitter. But the best thing about it is they are hugging, like a real bear hug, and in the background, YMCA is playing because that was Trump's walk-on movie music.
That's great.
So that's kind of exciting.
I would have preferred "I'm Too Sexy," honestly, but we'll take what we can get. Did Milei do like the rabbit ears, like behind his head, or like try to tug on?
No. He said
Superman's
are like. He said it was a pleasure to meet him, and he Trump made a joke about MAGA, meaning make Argentina great again, which I thought was pretty clever. And it showed a bit of cognitive acuity that is probably you're not going to see from Joe Biden.
Our standards are so low.
They're really low.
Speaking of low standards, did you see the picture or the interview where Joe Biden was talking about how he and Jill Biden have a great sex life? That's the secret to their marriage. And there's a picture of them clinching in the Oval Office, you know, as if she is an intern. I mean, it was mortifying.
Can we move on to another topic?
We have to talk for an hour,
so we might as well just get in the mud, I guess.
Joe Biden should be coming on to I'm Too Sexy. Yeah.
Let's pivot to Joseph Robinette Biden, the Vainglorious. He will on March 7th, which is 2 days after Super Tuesday, I got a lot of dates in my brain, be delivering his State of the Union address, which, according to reporting by Politico, he's going to be using it to attack shrinkflation and corporate greed. The latter of which got me thinking, we don't talk enough, family, about, government greed, do we? So, let's get our galaxy brains on and go around the table and each of us come up with an example of the government being greedy, Catherine.
So I think, you know, there's the government being greedy, but I think what Joe Biden is, you know, Joe Biden is not accusing the market of being greedy. He's accusing kind of individual companies or maybe even individual CEOs of being greedy. So I'm going to return the favor and say that the best example of government greed is public sector unions, because it's just individual people looking out for themselves at the direct cost of the taxpayer and of like the fiscal health of the nation or of their relevant states. Not only do we have this incredible, horrific, broad-based, unsustainable, accumulated obligations to public sector unions, there's been a lot of resistance to reforming, even for future generations. How those are structured. The Reason Foundation, which publishes this podcast, has done some good work in some states chipping away at that. So, you know, there's like occasionally a situation where you can kind of move from defined benefit to defined contribution like the rest of us schmoes. But for the most part, public sector unions are perfectly happy to know that the math is not mathing, that the numbers will never add up, and that the taxpayers will be bailing them out. And they're just going to proceed apace, assuming that that's going to work out. They are delighted to screw future generations without a single pause. And they fund political activity with that direct goal in mind. So just massive, massive, massive contributions, mostly to Democratic candidates, to sustain this unsustainable way of life as long as possible. If that is not greed, I don't know what is. Like, that is just a very direct, I'm going to take money that should be used for something else, has been promised for something else, money that we don't have, and I'm just going to put it in my retirement account, and then I'm going to go buy a boat in Boca. Screw you guys. Do they have boats in Boca? I don't really know.
Sure. Yeah, I think Marco Rubio had one, and it was a whole, like, it was like a month-long news story in 2015.
They're going to park their boat next to Marco Rubio's boat. And you and I have paid for it.
Do you think the public sector unions were mad when they saw the Barbie movie and she didn't say, math is hard?
Hmm. Wow. Wow.
I was going to say, it's going to be great when teachers unions in Alabama say, you know what? Yeah, those IVF frozen embryos are taxpayers. So they've got to be birthed. They've got to be birthed because we need that money. Otherwise, I can't buy the boat.
The embryos are going to count as enrolled students in the district where they are frozen for the purpose of appropriating like per capita student funding.
Yeah.
Let's not forget that our teachers' union friends managed to make sure that the well in excess of $100 billion that was thrown by the federal government in the direction of K-12 schools, which generally receive per year something like $40 billion from the entire Department of Education, maybe less, that almost all of that went to fund pensions and do hiring, and almost none of it, this is for COVID relief stuff, and almost none of it went to like get new air filtration systems or whatever it is, new water fountains.
And never forget, there is something for everyone to hate in public sector unions, because we have the police unions and we have the teachers unions. So just like summon up your most hated union and plug it into my argument.
When I wrote that piece back in 2020 or so, I was reliably informed, Catherine Mangu Ward, that those are two totally different things.
Oh, I see. Yeah. No, good point. There's actually absolutely nothing that those two unions have in common except for everything.
Either the teachers' unions were good and the police unions were bad, or vice versa. But it couldn't be that both of them shared a lot of characteristics that were negative.
My favorite is that is how forever on the left and the criminal justice reform people, they have centered the idea of private for-profit prisons being a source of not all evil, but lots of the evil in the system, compared to the less ballyhooed for them prison guards unions. And who do you think actually spends more money on lobbying? Guess. Look it up. All right. Nick. No, not yep. Nick. Peter. I keep mixing you guys up. Well, why not? Hey, come on.
This is like how my mom can't tell me and my brother apart.
Yeah, just call them all Sam. Sam, what's Sam Suderman? What's your example of government greed?
Sam, I am. So not that long ago, Washington State passed an excise tax on capital gains. And something happened right before that excise tax went into effect that is kind of notable. Jeff Bezos decided to relocate from Washington State to Florida. And he also sold about $15 billion in stocks right before the excise tax went into effect, which would have cost him about $70 million for every $1 billion worth of stocks that he sold, according to at least one estimate. That's a lot of money, $70 million. And he did $70 million. He avoided $70 million in excise tax 15 times by selling early. And this is also taking place in a state that has contemplated a wealth tax, just very similar to the wealth tax that we have seen proposed by Elizabeth Warren. And the wealth tax, I think it's related to the excise tax, sort of works a little bit like a wealth tax. It's not exactly the same thing. But the wealth tax is a really great example of government greed because it's stupid, because it's not even a good way to raise money. Like, if you want to raise money, there's just efficient ways to do that via taxation. A value-added tax, a VAT, is a pretty proven revenue raiser. But what has happened when just about every European country that has tried a wealth tax is they've actually repealed it because it didn't really raise a lot of revenue. Instead, what it did is it had what I'm going to call a Bezos effect. The producers, the people who were making money and who were wealthy in those countries, they just found some way to relocate to a jurisdiction that didn't have a wealth tax. And so what they ended up doing was depressing economic activity without raising a bunch of money. And so it's a really stupid sort of grab for other people's stuff from the government is what the wealth tax is. But it's also just totally ineffective at the thing that it is supposed to do, which is raise money for the government. And to be fair, there are at least some proponents of the wealth tax on the left, not mostly in the academic side of the world, who are kind of okay with that. They'll just say, well, you know, we'd like to raise some money with this, but the real goal is to punish wealthy people. They don't quite use the word punish, but they use words
sometimes
that are very close. They use words that are very close to this, and it's very their goals are very clear. It is just about punishing wealthy people for being wealthy. It has nothing to do with even raising tax revenue and having more money for the government to spend on dumb stuff.
Nick, can you tie us in with 1980s college rock?
As a matter of fact, I can, Matt. And I actually have two very quick examples. And the first is New York City ticketed my fiance this morning for riding a bike and supposedly running a red light.
Oh, my God.
And she got on a city bike, which is a heavily subsidized form of transport.
It's Huffy
incredibly
Gillespie,
convenient.
It turns out.
It's a $190 ticket. For running a red light.
It's a little low for what she deserves, but all right.
I don't know, but that's one way that government is overreaching here in the Big Apple.
When she told you this story, did she say she was too tired?
Uncircumcised men who are completely naked, painted in blue body paint, can walk around the city like it's their own personal, you know, sauna. I was thinking about David C. Lowery, who was the founder of Camper Van, Beethoven, and Cracker, two great groups. He was bitching over the weekend about how California just sent the band Camper Van Beethoven, which is an LLC based in Virginia and has been for years, an $800 bill for possibly having appeared there in 2023, which they did not. But he talked about how California has a bill on entertainers that they send out to people. If you've ever performed there, they kind of proactively do it. And that's on top of an 8% out-of-state entertainer fee that's on the gross revenue that you get. And he's, you know, he is self-consciously or self-identifies as a liberal. He said he's happy to pay, you know, taxes and things like that, but that this is insane. And that when you call, you can appeal this to the Franchise Tax Board in California, but there's nobody there. There's like no phone number. Nobody picks up or anything. And somebody in the comments of this thread said that there is a fax number that you can fax a request for somebody to call you from.
That's amazing.
And people wonder why, you know, businesses and individuals are leaving California for places like Texas and Florida, which have a lot less to offer based on, you know, just everyday niceness of the environment and things like that. California is inhospitable to humans and other living creatures.
My example of this is in general, it's red light cameras or traffic cameras for speeding tickets, which have been shown in study after study to be much more about generating revenue for localities or police, whatever's, than actually doing much of anything. Never, for example, drive, you know, even 8 miles over the limit on a freeway near the Phoenix airport is my recommendation. Although they might have taken those away. But no, specifically, it's the damn red light camera in downtown Brooklyn that said that I was going 10 miles over a school zone. Right. Okay. That's bad. I get it. That's bad. But it was during COVID. The schools were empty. Come on, man. All right.
I like all of these just turned into personal complaints.
Listen.
Well, you know, the personal is the political. Come on.
I do have a $200 red light camera ticket sitting on my desk right now.
Wow.
Worse, it's in a place where I knew the camera was. So, like, those things should be idiot taxes on non-locals, and it was an idiot tax on me this week.
Were you listening to a Justin Amash podcast while that's happened?
Mm. I don't do that anymore, Matt. I've learned my lesson, and I only
just read the transcripts.
Drive or scoot in ideal conditions, which do not include earbuds.
All right, we're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, the best relationships in your life aren't always the easiest. For instance, you could be married or have parents the same age, mental condition, and stubbornness as the President of the United States. Sometimes, in such trying cases, it can be helpful to do the work in order to get through the rough patches and to build a more functional future. Therapy can be a vital tool to get that work done. That's where BetterHelp online therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many listeners of this podcast put their metaphorical shoulder into some mental and emotional labor. All you have to do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist, and if you don't like the first one, just swap them out for a second. Let therapy be your internal Home Depot gift certificate with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/roundtable right now to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder, email your short queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one, which may be a bit broad, comes from Curtis Everett, who writes, like it or not, we, he means the United States here, often function as policemen for the world. Where should we draw the line? What are our interests? Should we look the other way when a nation pursues genocide? And is expansion by conquest all right? Can a nation provide safe haven for terrorists and pirates? Is homophobia or misogyny enough to make a country a pariah? I guess what I am really asking is if our diplomacy is effective and truly working. What are we doing right and what are we doing wrong? That's all, fine. We'll just do this in 30 seconds, Curtis Everett. I would suggest that we might focus on the where should we draw the line aspect, perhaps in light of the Ukrainian-Russia war, which is just past its two-year anniversary. But everyone can go wherever they want to with the question starting with Catherine.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this, you were actually right to flag at the very beginning of this question the use of we, right? Because this is actually something I try to, you know, use in my own writing and be careful in editing stuff that appears in Reason. The acts of the United States government are not synonymous with we the people. And so I think that, that already highlights the problem of, like, well, are we the world's – like, if I personally was the world's policeman, I would be doing things differently than the United States. And frankly, no one wants that. That would be not a better world is the world in which Catherine Mangy, your world is the world's policeman.
You are the world's policeman, though.
I'm the world's policeman.
In my life.
I'm not the world's policeman.
I have a ticket to fix if you are the world's policeman.
Voiding out all of your various traffic tickets. I one time got a jaywalking ticket, and I would retroactively erase that one as well.
And you thought it was a joke?
I didn't understand what was happening because I didn't understand jaywalking tickets were real things that were really
was that in D.C.?
It was in D.C.
Oh,
yeah,
God.
It was on K Street. Okay. So to answer the question, first of all, I think like this is not something that is easy to subject to democratic processes. And yet here we are trying to do that. In general, I think that the world maybe does not need a policeman, maybe should not have a policeman. There are going to be specific cases that are clear cut of U.S. interests. But I think that they are that phrase is almost always construed far too broadly. And, you know, the idea that maybe a series of dominoes fall, which leads to people within, you know, the physical boundaries of the United States being in danger, has been employed for a long time to get us involved in various shenanigans around the globe that have, in fact, ended up putting U.S. citizens in danger. If we send a bunch of U.S. citizens into a dangerous place, that's a good way, for example, for U.S. citizens to end up in danger. As I've said before in this podcast, am not an isolationist. I do not think that the answer is a radical one, but I am very confident that directionally we should be doing much, much, much less in other people's business all around the world than we are doing right now.
Nick, how would you answer Curtis Everett's question?
This way, because he asks at the end, you know, how is our diplomacy doing or something along those lines? And the real question is, our warring has been very bad. In the 21st century, we've spent most of the 21st century so far in active shooting wars. And we have a lot of troops all over the place now. We're not in a war like we were in Iraq and Afghanistan forever. But that was not good for America, and it was not good for the world. I looked up a couple of indices of freedom around the world. The Freedom House shows that global freedom declined for the 17th consecutive year. As of last year, they're about to come out with their next one, which will continue that trend. The Fraser Institute says 90% of the world's population saw a decline in freedom from 2019 to 2021. Cato says 83% of the world's population saw a decline since 2008. This is bad, and it's a sign that our actual projection of force throughout the world was not good, but also our diplomacy is not doing very much. I mean, I think what is best is for America to have a very clear foreign policy when it comes to military intervention, which has to do with, maintaining whatever alliances that we have that are important, and there should be fewer of those. But dealing with that, and then especially protecting the lives and property of American citizens. But we need to be doing less there. But we do need to be doing more in order to kind of create a world that has more free migration in it, more free speech, more free economic work and things like that. And we're not doing that. So I think partly because we think instinctively of intervention as being something that's military. And it really, that should be the last resort, and it should be something that we are wary of.
Peter, what say you?
I think too many people look at this as a question of what event is so bad that we must intervene. That's not a completely useless question, but I don't think it's really the best or the most important question. The most important question is, in what circumstances can we make a positive outcome, a difference that is going to be beneficial to the United States and to the world? And if you look at the history of interventions, military interventions in the post-war era, the majority of instances in which the United States has sent troops to fight elsewhere, there have been the result has not been good. There have been unintended consequences. Things have been drawn out. And this is kind of, this is maybe not literally true in every single case, but it is true in so many instances where we send troops around the rest of the world, where we involve ourselves in either wars or pseudo wars. There are a lot of unintended consequences. Things get drawn out. Things become chaotic very quickly. That's kind of how war is, and you can't avoid it. And so I think the thing is not to say, well, if there's a genocide, we intervene. The question is, if there's a genocide that we can just stop, save a bunch of lives, and make the world a better place, make the United States a better place, maybe that's a case for intervention. But those decisions we just don't have a high enough bar right now for intervention, because too many of our leaders are just far too confident about our ability to intervene cleanly and without unintended consequences.
So one way of I try to answer this question or think about it is by remembering my Billy Joel and recognizing that sovereignty is such a lonely word. At least in the way that it's a Reason headline from back in the day, shockingly, at least in terms of the way that we think about foreign policy, that used to be kind of the foundation of the way that nation states deal with one another. Like, if you're having a civil war, you know, unless it's the Cold War and we're getting our thumbs involved in places that we probably shouldn't, not a whole lot that we can do. But if you're going to war against your neighbor, that disrupts the international order in such a way that there's going to have to be, or there is likely to be, let's say, some kind of response, whether it's collective at, you know, the United Nations level or some other kind of response, that is intolerable. And people should be focusing on the intolerability of wars of expansion. So to answer one of the questions here, is expansion by conquest all right? No. It is not all right. Don't expand by conquest. Stop doing it. Stop it.
You're going to send a strongly worded letter about that?
Strongly worded letter. And sometimes, you know what? Strongly worded letters are all you can do. There are many times, even within the context of the Cold War, where a lot of more hawkish Cold Warriors were furious at Dwight Eisenhower, at Ronald Reagan, for not doing more than strongly worded letters when the Soviet Union, for example, put down uprisings in Budapest, Hungary in 1956, in Czechoslovakia in 1968, and such like, and or in Poland, Solidarity in 1981. And in each case, the American Republican presidents said, look, we can't get drawn into a broader war here, but we can absolutely denounce it in very strong moral language and issue a strongly worded letter. I think what's happened now is that because sovereignty has been so serially violated after the international response to Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait in 1990, during which the U.S. and Soviet Union like literally stood shoulder to shoulder. Gorbachev and George H.W. Bush stood shoulder to shoulder and said that this is intolerable. They also used the phrase, we're going to enter a new world order. So maybe that wasn't the greatest press conference. But
get into a black helicopter and fly off?
A Black Hawk helicopter. But that was, I think, a correct kind of impulse of saying that's the thing that we can't have more of. But then afterwards, the U.S., I think, made the tragic mistake of deciding that after we routed Saddam, that we felt bad that we didn't go all the way to Baghdad. And thus began a series of the U.S. on the right saying, God, we should have really like taken him out when we had the chance. We started doing no-fly zones. We started violating the sovereignty of the lousy dictatorial country of Iraq. and creating all these tripwires that if they crossed them, we would have to invade them again, which is what eventually led to the 2003 war in Iraq and all of these things. My viewer mistake. One of the questions here is should we look the other way when a nation pursues genocide? No, we should not. But that doesn't mean we should intervene militarily. We used genocide as the tripwire excuse to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi. Again, a really bad guy. In 2011, it was the not even a genocide, but that we were worried that he might do a genocide sometime pretty soon in one specific city. And that was enough to absolutely destabilize an entire region using American and I think French power. And I think those are mistakes. If you focus more just on the question of sovereignty and then use your diplomacy to try to create collective action agreements among people who still believe in those kind of things, I think that's a better anchor to put foreign policy things in.
Where does that leave us with Ukraine? Because we're in a post-Cold War era, and this is, you know, part of the issue is that framework doesn't make, you know, the framework of not intervening everywhere all the time during the Cold War makes sense because there's a bigger battle. You know, and Matt, you said the violation of an international border is something to take very seriously. So should we be defending Ukraine? Should we be defending Ukraine more? Should we be defending it less? How do we, can we work towards a negotiated settlement there? I think that we should definitely not be involved militarily in Ukraine, certainly not with troops. We also don't have an actual defense agreement with them, but we might play a role in settling the conflict at this point on terms that are not going to be ideal for Ukraine, certainly, but might be better in the long run for stability in the region.
Well, any like sort of Vivek Ramaswamyan idea that the U.S. should sit down with Russia and decide what's best for Ukraine, to me, is repugnant and redolent. And Trump has made some noises to that, but he's all over the map as usual. There's been many cases where countries in Central Europe's fate has been decided at great power negotiations at which they were not invited. And it's a really bad history, one that every single president basically has apologized for up until Trump. He doesn't really do a lot of the apologizing thing. But, you know, no more Munichs, no more Yaltas, as they say over and over again. In my view, and this is not a libertarian or not a majority libertarian view, I don't think anyone wants to send U.S. troops to Ukraine. I don't think it's like any person really has suggested that. There isn't really any tripwire to make that happen. There is something to suggest that, you know, the Budapest Memorandum of 1994, at which Ukraine gives up its nuclear weapons in exchange for feeling like they might not get invaded by Russia anymore, and U.S. and England were signatories to that. That suggests a level of interest and seriousness about how badly Russia has violated that, and that we should feel as people who are primary drivers of that negotiation, feel pretty bad about that. And also for those who don't like to see a lot of nuclear proliferation, that's the last time any country gives up its nukes. You can be damn sure. I personally think it's fine to help arm Ukraine as they are fighting a defensive war against people who are trying to steal their sovereignty. But I think that you have to submit that to the democratic process in the United States, and you have to convince American voters that it is worthwhile, and you should have a standalone vote and series of debates in Congress to do that, and do it with clear eyes that you might be funding a cause that maybe was lost from the beginning, or at least in terms of keeping Crimea, let alone Donbass, or Donbass, let alone Crimea. So that's what I think, but it's not a dominant majority view, to say the least.
Although, you know, you, in preparing notes for this, you showed, was it a Pew poll?
Pew Research poll,
Yeah, it was, I mean, about 75% of Americans think that it's, you know, very important for the U.S. to be involved, or, you know, in Ukraine, in Israel, in Taiwan. I mean, so there's a strong predisposition among the American people, and Lord knows not everything should be decided on a vote or through a democratic process, but, you know, you seem to be where most Americans are.
Well, one thing that I've written about a lot and am trying to write more in the future, did a magazine story very soon after the war, called After the War, but I argued, one, that we bungled the post-Cold War settlements, that we didn't actually achieve a peace. Every time you do that, after you get out of a war, you should be involved with the great questions of, all right, where are the borders? What do we do with the refugees? And how do we handle questions of collective security guarantees? Those are important. They happen every time, and they didn't really happen this time. And then Europe continued to dither instead of creating new structures. And then we sort of like sighed very wearily, and then came in Yugoslavia. And then the rest is kind of this bad history that we've had ever since. I think all of that is problematic. But one of the things I argued there is that respecting American public opinion, you have to have some anchor in American public opinion, or else your policy is not going to be able to last. And in fact, the American public opinion has been wiser in many respects than leaders in Washington would have. American public opinion was against the League of Nations after World War I pretty vociferously. And I think they were right about that. They had a sense of responsibility after World War II, which led to support for the great kind of 1948 spasm of creating these multilateral institutions, including ones that created more free trade and collective security arrangements, which allowed Europe to rebuild. I think those were wise to do then. So if you tether American foreign policy towards public opinion more and respect it and make clear articulations, I think you will find that in some places, and those three places are very central to that, Taiwan, Israel, and Ukraine, that to the perhaps chagrin of the more anti-interventionist among us, Americans will say, yeah, I don't really care about, defending, Montenegro or some damn place, but Ukraine means something to us. And that should be factored in. I think if you did have a standalone vote in Congress and a debate and all the media and such that were associated, I think that Mike Lee and J.D. Vance would lose the argument. And I think it's kind of a damn shame that they don't have it, because I want to see it and I want to be convinced one way or the other. But they're just tethering it with a bunch of border nonsense, which I think is silly. And now I've been talking too long and I feel bad. Let's get to our end of podcast, what we all have been consuming in the cultural arena. Peter, why don't you lead us off?
I watched the first season of Yellowstone. So this has been one of the biggest hits on television over the last couple of years. It is interestingly a story, it's interesting as a media story because this show caught on, not in the places where scripted dramas that are prestige elite TV or sort of HBO style shows like Game of Thrones or Succession catch on. It caught on actually in smaller cities in red states and then grew from there. And so this is a sort of a red state phenomenon. And of course, it's about a ranch out in Bozeman or in the Bozeman area. It's sort of a family succession drama, actually a lot like Succession, except with ranch politics, right? So you've got an elder who is about who is not long for this world, played by Kevin Costner. And then he's got these children and sort of trying to figure out exactly how to pass on his land and his, to give them their inheritance. But also there are interlopers from the big city who are trying to buy up land and build resorts. And then, of course, there's the Indian reservation, which has its own motivations and plots. And it's just a kind of a fascinating show in a bunch of ways. The pilot, I will say, just as a sort of exercise in TV writing, is really one of the very best TV pilots I have ever seen. Just an absolutely masterful exercise in setting up a story and bringing you in a 2-hour stretch. It's a double length episode. And then the show is for this podcast's purposes, very interestingly about land use. Like, the whole thing is about the laws and the culture surrounding what you can build where, on whose property, and with whose permission. And I mean, one of the big plot points in the first episode is actually you need a power and a water source if you're going to build a subdivision. But if that river waterway that is going to run through that subdivision, if upstream of that somebody else owns it, that person has the power to do whatever they want with rerouting that river or that stream. And that, of course, can make things interestingly complicated. So it's just a great show about land use, the law, family, succession, and it's gorgeous. It's truly gorgeous. All of this incredible location photography. So I don't know how the show is going to develop. And the creator of it, Taylor Sheridan, is now writing like 6 different TV shows, some of which are related to Yellowstone. There's prequels. There's a sequel coming out with Matthew McConaughey. But I would say that to people who have maybe stayed away from this because they've heard it's very soapy or it's super right-wing coded, it's much more nuanced than you might think, at least in the first season. And if you are a fan of kind of well-written shows about politics and American culture in set in contemporary America, it's a good show, and it's just really well made.
If it hasn't been done yet, someone should do a book-length treatment or a magazine essay for Catherine, reading purposes, of how the ultimate avatar of boomer cinema and whose entire career can be sort of interpreted through the arc of the boomer lifestyle is Kevin Costner. There's just nobody else who comes close. It's something that I came face-to-face with when writing about Field of Dreams, one of his many kind of like explicit sort of boomer roles dealing with the elder generation and their anxieties over it all. And I'm sure this all fits perfectly into it. Catherine,
and by the way, do Matt rewrite that essay with a section on Kevin Costner's unconscious plagiarism, which is the thing George Harrison was found guilty of F Troop in making Dances with Wolves. It's essentially a serious version of F Troop.
That is fantastic. Catherine, what did you consume?
I don't know if you know, but stuff happened in space this week. So Woo! Obviously that is what I am consuming. Intuitive Machines Odysseus Lander. This is the first U.S. spacecraft to have soft landed on the moon since Apollo 17. So it's been a minute since 1972. And the first time, that a commercial aircraft has done it. Spacecraft, rather. So that's very exciting. That's just going to that already hits the KMW bingo card pretty hard. It was also very dramatic. The laser arrays went wrong. There was lots of it. They were Apollo mission style, at the last minute trying to change out the different systems so that it would all work just barely in time. When it did land, it landed on its side, which the interesting part of this to me is that they didn't know it landed on its side for a while because the way that the information was coming back was all adjusted for that fact. So they were like, we did it. It landed correctly. And then they were like, hold on. Wait a minute. Is everything actually turned over? Even though it landed on its side, it seems like it will be able to complete most of its mission. These landers have a very short half-life. They basically last for somewhere between 7 to 10 days, and then the lunar night comes and freezes them to death. It's if you, like me, have empathy only for machines, you feel very sad for them as they die in the cold. But the Japanese lander, which went up in mid-January, has surprisingly survived a couple of lunar nights. So there is a chance that, like the Mars rovers before them, this little guy might live through the night and tell us more information. In the meantime, super cool triumph for private space, super cool U.S. return to the moon, and also just great, feat of engineering and ingenuity on the part of the Intuitive Machines team. So great work, everybody. Super cool.
What are they hoping to do up there?
Just futzing around, to be quite honest. Yeah. There's the mission of getting there is most of it. This one is, I think it's the closest to the south pole of the moon or something of any previous lander. They are theoretically scoping out sites for the Artemis missions, which I personally believe might never happen and aren't real and are just a figment of Uncle Sam's imagination. But that is... that is in theory what they are doing, is looking at the terrain in a new part of the moon. As always, there's the little moment where it's maybe we found ice, maybe we found water, maybe we found something that's going to be useful. But mostly, I think they did it to see if they could do it.
Nick, besides the rogue Blue Man group that you encountered on the streets of Manhattan, what have you been consuming?
I watched over the weekend The Coddling of the American Mind, which is a documentary by Ted Ballacher, late of Reason, and Courtney Ballacher, his wife. They co-directed it. It's based on the book of that name by John Haidt and Greg Lukianoff. And what's interesting about this is it spends more time talking to college students rather than, you know, kind of adults who are kind of looking at what's going on in college campuses. The other thing that's interesting about it is that it is being kind of premiered at Substack. So if you go to a Substack and Google Coddling of the American Mind, it's supposedly the first full-length documentary that is being premiered and debuted on Substack. So it kind of opens up that platform, which is, you know, one of the most interesting kind of developments in internet, I don't know if you want to call it social media or whatever, you know, over the past few years. But it's another kind of feather in its cap for a way of kind of delivering really interesting curated content. So it's The Coddling of the American Mind. And if you go down a rabbit hole with the Balakai, Ted and Courtney, you might also check out their previous movie, which was a feature called Little Pink House from 2018 that told the story of Suzette Kilo versus those overreaching government corporate busybodies in New London, Connecticut.
Yes. I think if you look at the film market right now, it's an interesting story in the context of the business atmosphere for independent film, because there are two things that are happening right now, is that movies that are going through the festival circuit are having a harder time getting picked up and getting distribution, and funding for documentaries, which had boomed in the sort of the streaming build-out era, pre-pandemic in particular. There was just a ton of money floating around to make documentaries, and that has dried up. And so when you see this movie premiering on Substack, first of all, it's great. It's you know, super interesting about sort of campus free speech and all of that, but also, just as a sort of a distribution story in independent media, it is fascinating. And it's great to see that Substack is taking a chance on this sort of thing and creating a platform where folks like the Balakai and, you know, Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt can get their work seen.
I consumed, like I do about once a year, Saturday Night Live, which is a comedy television show that appears on NBC on 11:30 on Saturday nights for the past several years. Because Shane Gillis was the host. And if you don't follow Shane Gillis, I think he's a pretty funny comedian. Other people have different views, but he was spectacularly unhired by Saturday Night Live within days of being hired a few years ago when allegedly homophobic and racist comments were resurfaced or something like that. I forget the term of art. They looked into his milieu. And there was a outrage, feigned or real, and so he kind of was unhired at the time. He went and created his own career, which is spectacularly successful, and so they brought him back as host. I wish he was funnier. I'm a Shane Gillis fan. I think he's pretty gifted. I've talked about him here before. He has a way of just sort of straddling a lot of different worlds, empathetically, but also humorously. Monologue at the top was just very clearly very nervous. I can understand that, but also, come on, man. But some of the sketches were pretty good, and the one that I would recommend and that we'll link to is the one that was, I think it was called White Men Can Trump. It's about the Trump shoes. So a schlubby Shane Gillis, which is redundant, is just kind of going through life being kind of like the Henry Winkler character in the Night Shift movie. Just always picked on. That's deep cut. Always picked on, always losing, not getting by, and certainly playing horrible basketball. But then he buys the new Trump shoes, which if you haven't seen are spectacular, $399 gold Converse with American flags on them.
Gold lame, right?
I think so, yeah. And
I don't even know what lame is. I just heard that's what it was.
And lame? Is that how we're pronouncing that?
It's pronounced lame. Lame. Yeah. We talked about it last week on the podcast.
Let's be pluralist about pronunciation.
At any rate, the joke is
I'm the words police, as you may recall.
I will explain the joke, but it's also funny that when he gets the shoes, then he goes back on the basketball court and he shoots the shot just as badly as he did before. But when everyone's like, "Come on, man, that sucked," he's like, "What are you talking about?" It went right in. And he's like incredibly confident that everything that he does is awesome. So much so that the people around him start kind of believing it too. And it's pretty funny the way it plays out. So go check. And also he's got a one of the better Trump accents impersonations out there. Although the other dude on Saturday Night Live has a great one too. And then they both interact. But what was noteworthy, in addition to like this being kind of a moment where it seems like the cancel culture pendulum is swinging back to a more rational place, is that even in the Trump shoes skit, but also in the Weekend Update part, they did Biden jokes, like made fun of Biden being old and stumbling on himself, which for a long time was really, really hard to find any example of like what you would normally do with an old doddering president, which is make fun of him being old and doddering. Maybe a sign that it's okay. Now that Ezra Klein told everyone it's okay to point out that the president
the
is
Pope
old.
The Pope of comedy, he broke that ice jam.
The commissar of comedy. Yeah. But anyways,
actually, Jon Stewart did in a profound way when he returned to The Daily Show. And I think Against All Odds was actually funny.
Yeah.
Because he was honest about the humor.
Yes.
How you just love both sides. Yeah.
That's true. If you can't, if you don't use both sides, you can't pilot a kayak, Peter Suderman. Catherine will tell you that.
Wow.
From a yachting.
Thank you. I'm so happy to have you back, Matt. We missed you.
I'm back and I'm, what is it? Chief brown bearing, Nick, as we speak. Although hopefully that's not being shown on video. All right. Thank you for listening and watching. God help you all. The Reason Roundtable podcast and video cast. We do it every week. Check us out. Go to all of our podcasts at reason.com podcasts. There you can also see the Soho Forum debate. There's one tonight with Eli Lake, and I don't have the other dude's name in front of me, but they're talking in a sold out forum here in New York City. But you can follow it online, apparently. A debate over Israel and Hamas. So it's going to be very spicy. That's going to be one.
Jeremy Hammond is his interlocutor.
Thank you for saving me and rescuing me. Nick, are there any other New York events that you want to hype while we're still talking?
Everything that's up and ready will be at reason.com/events. So look there and sign up for our newsletters at reason.com/newsletters, including the NYC events newsletter.
Nice. And then if you'd like to donate to the foundation that makes our work possible, reason.com donate. Okay, thanks. See you next week.